Welcome to the Business and Leadership Channel. My name is Michelle Boulay, and I'm so honored to be a sponsor here at this amazing conference because it's my passion to help you connect to your own inner leader and let that transform the businesses and relationships you create. I'm a life coach and healer and an internationally recognized award-winning dance artist. And dancing taught me to listen to my own inner voice and let that guide me to my success. A very common thing that happens for business owners, creatives, and leaders is that you're so close to your next goal or breakthrough and then you stop. Doubt kicks in, worry, procrastination, fear, overwhelm, which kill growth in your business and creative process. So I'm giving a talk here on Saturday, October 24th, where you'll learn tools so that you can show up with clarity and belief in yourself and your ideas, consistency to keep showing up, and the embodied and intellectual understanding to move you gracefully through the challenges you'll meet as you grow, as you go for your goals. If you can't make it live, pick up your phone now, go to Instagram or Facebook, find me, follow me, and DM me the word success, and I'll send you the free resource I'll be sharing at my presentation. It's also in the show notes. However, I do recommend you attend live here or at my main stage presentation to get the full scope of what I'll be sharing to help you realize your creative dreams. And now, please enjoy this next presentation.
So I'd like to introduce our presenter, Fazam Shadab, to this session. He's the founder of Inaxian, Interactive, and Project Holopedia. Fazam has a background in cognitive science. Fazam also seeded Jimmy Wales with his first concepts for what would become known as Wikipedia in 1998. Embodiment integration is the focus of his current approach to technology. I will now hand over to Fazam as he talks about technology of the embodiment paradox.
Thank you, Pam. Thank you so much. And thank you all for attending and future listeners as well. It's a real honor to be here participating with Mark Walsh's Embodiment Conference. And I have participated in prior years. Watching the evolution of this community has been in and of itself very, very stunning. And it's really called me to a perspective of integral integration, the desire to really pull together either a framework or a set of rules or principles that will, as time proceeds, bring this vast body of knowledge that Mark and his incredible community, including all of you here, his support team, have elegantly made seem like it's been a subculture that's existed in its own robust, rich form for decades now. Any one of us who has been deeply involved in any particular community of practice or embodiment modality, system-wise, definitely knows that you can feel like you're a bit on the margins. Maybe it's a movement modality, maybe it's a mindfulness training practice or modality, but the general sense tends to be that these things are still a bit not on the main of things. They're on the fringe. And the Embodiment Conference has effectively become its own. I was just going through all the schedule. It's like an index or an encyclopedia itself to what's out there. So hats off to all of you who play the research and support roles, because it really speaks to the focus of my talk tonight. Tonight, California time, early morning, 4 a.m. UK time, and who knows what time you'll be listening to this when you choose to listen to the recording. So we're talking today about the actual technology paradox around embodiment. And we know that there are lots of definitions of embodiment and that there are lots of interpretations of the benefits of technology in our lives now. So with the time that we have and the people here, we are going to explore a framework that I've been designing for well over a decade now that seeks to work with and accept what's already true now about our technological circumstance, the cultural reality that we're all enmeshed in to varying degrees with a love it or hate it kind of mindset, right? I would venture to guess that the vast majority of us have very mixed feelings about our utilization of and reliance on our tools. We're gradually inculcated into technological, I don't want to use heavy-handed language here, but systems that become culture, that carry with them their own practices, that become habits. And a lot of what we want to get into in this examination of the paradoxes of it is around the practices becoming a form of entrainment, how then once we identify a particular entrainment, that precise entrainment becomes the pivot point to transform the practice. I'm going to give an example right now that tends to have been really perhaps driven by the technology designers. They may be hardware manufacturers. It may be your iPhone engineers who have studied human factors in their own domain, which arguably is not particularly integrative, that it looks at a human being from a particular lens, which is its own individual facet of embodiment, and then proceeds to design tools and techniques with existing technology to engage the user toward some prescribed end goal. The one example I'm going to utilize right now is something probably no one can get by a day, go through one day without having to rely on, which is something we just take for granted, which is this concept of infinite scroll. Now that may not seem that special, but it from a design of the web point of view, from a mobile internet point of view, over a decade ago became a distinction because it's something that everyone kind of came together on and said, well, we'll make sure that the software and the algorithms continue to feed in information so that it seemingly never runs out or is at least longer than most people's attention span and gives you this experience of this sort of infinite feed. Now, that is a practice. And that specific practice in and of itself begets various entrainments. That entrainment is an opportunity, one of many that me and my teams and other organizations that I've begun to align with are creating new practices, which we will discuss after we identify them, that then can give us opportunities to bring embodiment systems, such as those represented here at the Embodiment Conference, into play. I would like to make the claim that the embodiment community here is in and of itself the very important beginnings of a platform to change and transform the global technological infrastructures that are basically woven into every aspect of life. Those elements of these practices have entered into our cultural milieu in a very, very short time frame. For some, 20 years may have been your entire life if you're in your early 20s. For others, it may be a blink of an eye, and in as much as you've watched everything get touched by this. Now, there are critical perspectives on technology as a form of cultural control or even mediation. So you start to see terms like technocracy or technocratic control or even technological social engineering enter conversations. And at times, you know, those can feel very spot on. It's like, wow, from the time I wake up to the time I go to sleep, within 5 minute spans, I'm maybe engaging my phone 2 to 3 times. Our mobile devices have become sort of so ubiquitous that if we are to lose our device, many of us will feel as if we are displaced, incapable of functioning fully, if at all. And basically, in a sense, becoming more and more hardwired. Now, that element of this conversation would potentially branch off into a much different dialogue, which we will save for another conference at another time. But right now, our focus is on how are we engaging these paradoxes, our need to rely on technological tools and systems, and at the same time, pursue our goals of greater embodiment, greater self-development, ideally integration of higher aspects of ourselves. I'm remembering right now that there is a very specific point about the infinite scroll practice, no one terms it a practice. It's woven into the assumed set of, you know, givens around the relationship with these devices that are now more and more even woven in at the societal level, so that things like paying your taxes, paying your bills, voting, participating in electronic governance, et cetera, are starting to require this, depending on where you live and to what degree they've technologized their governmental systems. Now, that being the case, let's take into consideration a simple human factors element, which is something we're all doing right now, blinking. Unless you're lying down listening to this, you're looking at this presentation and you're looking at a screen. Some new research came out that actually documented that the human blink rate reduces from a norm of around 20 on average to somewhere between 3 to 7 blinks on average while you're looking at a screen, be it a mobile device or your computer. Now, that may seem like a pretty boring statistic and very insignificant in and of itself, but when you recognize that our tear ducts support the conductivity of our vision, our visual systems are very much impacted by the light that we're basically sitting in front of. We know that topics such as blue light toxicity, their mediation of our hormones, our hormonal systems through a technical detail, something called melanopsin in the retina that regulates a lot of how your melatonin is mediated through the day. We've all certainly in these communities learned a lot about turning off your devices before a certain hour of the day. Yet at the same time, our devices, and this is another example of a paradox, seem to be time-saving devices because we may cram in a bunch of research, reading, email, or communications an hour before bed that we didn't accomplish during the day in order to feel like we are complete with our day. But that is necessarily, from all the new neuroscience that's before us, actually at the expense of the quality of our sleep. So preventing us from getting the deeper sleep we may require, and then therefore having a negative feedback loop, which is also part of an entrainment cycle into the subsequent day, which again, as you extrapolate this, you start to get greater and greater vicious cycles of reliance on the technology and some kind of disintermediation of a healthy rhythm. So on the other side of the entrainment coin is basically self-regulation. And we talk a lot about the basic biorhythms of well-being. So entrainment and personal rhythms or biorhythms, which can again seem like very mundane elements of our lives, are things that are effectively hijacked. So I'm going to use that slightly dramatic word. It's a little sensational. It's not necessarily a literal hijacking, but as practices become deep habits that are practiced hundreds of thousands of times, you can actually run the neuroscientific tests necessary to prove and validate that the actual usage of your device has effectively, to use a phrase that Tristan Harris and the folks at the Center for Humane Technology phrase it, have hijacked your limbic system. And so we've also all probably been exposed to research that has just done something really simple, which is grab a bunch of adults, put them in a room, ask them to put their cell phones on the other side of the room, and then ask them politely to not pick up their phones for just 20 minutes. And in that test, they actually start to call their cell phones or send text messages. And the act of the sound of hearing the notifications while these people are being measured with one device or another basically starts to bring about limbic arousal. And from that limbic arousal, there can be various different levels of stress response. Different people, based on their level of personal practice, might have that fairly under control. And other people start to experience emotions such as anxiety when they can't get to their notification within a matter of seconds. So that's a pretty reliable way of looking at and accurately measuring and therefore declaring that these devices, which are arguably still in their first phases of enrollment in our lives, involvement in our lives, have still yet to be properly placed in lifestyles of practice that actually manage our well-being. Again, the reason there's a concept of paradox that I'm relying on is because the little conversation you're having in your head throughout your day usually is some kind of negotiation around, well, even though maybe I'm in a shallower state of consciousness, a shallower state of cognition, I'm actually at the moment saving myself time, making more free time available later, and somehow, some way going to benefit in the whole. So I'm going to pause on that point because Pam and I had spoken about the possibility of people sharing questions throughout the talk. I'm going to ask if there are any questions, and if there are, and I'll just continue.
Any questions, anybody? Anybody want to pop a question in the Q&A box? Please welcome it. But Fazim, you can perhaps carry on, and if there is a question, I'll just give you a polite interruption.
Can I ask a question live like this?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
I'm really engaged with this topic because I grew up out in the country, and now technology is just part of my everyday, and I'm like, it's very, anyway, the tear duct regulating vision, can the blink time, can you repeat that fact and why the tear ducts, what that has to do with our vision and how we regulate what we're seeing?
Absolutely. And there's even a few other choice tidbits I didn't get into around that. So basically, apparently there's tear ducts that are where we expect them, where we experience our crying, but there's also tear ducts in our eyelids that have to do with the blinking and the regular act of, moistening and clearing the eye. So what they've associated with this reduced blink rate is a shrinking down of these tear ducts and actually some decline in vision. So we're seeing earlier vision loss. And what we're basically also getting is, and this is a point that's going to resonate more with people who are in the embodiment communities, is a focus on the gross body. So you're usually also correlated with that. And there's more research to come on this. And I hope members of this community would like to participate in that. Is shallower breathing. So you're basically usually in an autonomic state of breathing, right? Unless you're a fairly practiced breathwork person, your limbic hijack that we referred to earlier is actually bringing you into an autonomic state of shallower attention, which is okay. This is part of a broader integral approach to this stuff, is not making gross states necessarily bad and elevating subtle and even causal and those that are related there into some kind of spiritual bypassed, value statement around needing to necessarily always be in some kind of elevated state of being. But for people who aren't even necessarily entering into those worlds of practice, these devices, from my point of view, are locking an entire generation or two or three into habituation of shallower states, mediated by visual input that's nearly constant. It's always available. Some part of your unconscious or limbic system knows that it's within reach. There's lots of research now on the distractibility of today's teenagers, the overall attention span of the average adult. And then ultimately, when you start to even attempt to get into conversations around contemplative practices, mindfulness training of any sort, and in general, the long-term practice of these things, these are things that are beyond paradoxical. They're contraindicated to one another. Somebody who may have experienced a higher state of awareness and sustained it, such as witness consciousness, is not necessarily going to consider the feedback loops that are built into their smartphone, particularly resonant with how their mind orients, nor functional for maybe how they process. So it's like they're doing this act of cognitive charity, if I can phrase it that way, if that speaks to that. But Sarah, you also were asking about the nature of vision and vision mediation and why that might matter. And I hung a couple of other points on that. there's additional very important research about, I know that there's a study from Japan on young men who grew up with devices, who have entered their 20s, who clearly seem to be dealing with lower testosterone levels. And what correlates with that, of course, is a lower sperm count. And that whole category of consideration looks into their overall identities and behaviors around dating and partnership. And so from the very technocratically positive Japanese culture, there's clear data that the reliance on the devices, the continuous exposure to blue lights, the blue light toxicity feedback loops, the dysregulation of circadian rhythms, okay? So that's a deeper neuroscientific and neuropsychological point about mental wellness. It's what happens when we dysregulate circadian rhythms regularly over time. We know that one's mental balance and cognitive capacities are definitely challenged, but that specifically this body of younger Japanese men that were studied had lower sperm count and far less interest in pursuing the opposite sex. And when they did, it was through a virtual platform. So they were doing a lot of online dating and would literally report in their research materials that a date for them could constitute meeting online. So real world stuff, as more and more generations of people matriculate into these technological cultures, seems to be something that they're totally okay with not having take place in a real physical manner. And
awesome.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. We have a couple of questions. I have a couple of questions here from Ronald, who asks, blue light and protective glasses, are they helpful? And where does one get them? And can you also define limbic hijacking?
Sure. And good to see you, Ronald. I have my glasses right here. Mine are clear. Many people's are yellow tinted, typically. I definitely recommend just going into Amazon or your e-commerce platform of choice and searching on blue light, blue blockers or blue light filtering glasses. There's quite a bit of them out there. Normally at this time of day, I'll wear these, usually sunset onward towards bedtime. There's a 95%+ rate of reduction of the blue light coming in. And it absolutely allows for the natural processes of melatonin production. Melatonin, as it builds in your bloodstream throughout the day, basically guides you to sleep at night in a manner that is organic to your physiological needs. Now, we can disrupt that and effectively shine lights into people's faces and then let other physiological processes kick in to make them go to sleep, usually at the wrong time. It's also known that blue light projectors, lamps and whatnot, are used in the morning time to help program people into being awake and regulated to a certain earlier morning hour time for people who need that. I know there's depression research on the use of blue lights early in the morning on purpose to help re-regulate the circadian neurology. One fun fact from the neuroscience of all this, it turns out each individual neuron in our brains has its own circadian clock, so to speak. So you can have a late night, go stay up till 4 a.m., have an appointment at 9 a.m., so you're up at 8 a.m., and go start driving a motor vehicle and present a meeting on 4 hours sleep and say to yourself, wow, I pulled it off. But what they've done neurologically in their studies is identify that significant portions of your physiological neural matter are actually turned off. And this is the work of Dr. Yi Jin. I'm more than happy to reference his work. Dr. Yi, first name, and Jin, J-I-N, last name, on this. And I think he has a TEDx talk as well on just circadian rhythms and mental wellness. And in his labs and research was able to specifically prove that individual neurons will basically go on strike and say, well, you didn't give me enough sleep. Well, guess what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna sort of cycle off, downregulate. I've gotta do my work. So what you're gonna do is you're gonna have less neural matter supporting you. And you know, there are sophisticated tests for actually proving that being sleep deprived can be approximate to being inebriated, and the coffee kicks in, and maybe you think, you know, the caffeine is going to get you through it, but still there is some degree of neurological compromise. And these are ideal, non-ideal lifestyles, but ideal practices to start engaging as far as managing one's circadian well-being. We also talk about that in the language of sleep hygiene. And that's a great topic to Google. Wow. Sleep hygiene is blown up like crazy the last several years. And there's so many support tools out there, from HRV sleep apps, which you can use with your phone off at night to study and support and read and interpret how you sleep, to also keeping you on track and all that lovely stuff.
Fazim, I have another question from Beverly. She asks, I have a question about the relation of optic nerves to oral nerves. Are there any studies showing relationship as well as to how when we are unable to pick up other sensory information as well?
Okay, so just to clarify, I want to make sure I understand the question. Oral nerves. So I have two spellings of oral in my head. A-U-R-A-L.
A-U-R-A-L.
Auditory. Okay. Yeah. So I don't immediately know of any relationship, but I'm sure there are those. Feel free to re-ask the question. I'm happy to answer it with any further distinctions, Beverly.
And here's another question from Jillian. She says, I feel like the chronic exposure to and of limbic arousal has a systemic implication of increasing states of sensation addiction, locking entire generations into shallower states of consciousness, as many multidimensional dangerous has so many dangerous implications.
Yes, Jillian, thank you for that. And hello to you and Max, I think, as well. I definitely want to recognize the brilliance of that question. And yeah, I mean, there are so many areas this extends into. The embodiment communities are definitely in whole recognition of the fact that when we identify some area where bad practices are in play, or there's some dysregulation or downregulation of physiological well-being, so-called multidimensional aspects of self are also compromised, and the sensational addictions around that. You all may or may not have heard about, in China, there are entire addiction rehab centers for typically teenage age people, because gaming culture is so significant there, where they just cold turkey rip them out of their conventional environments, their home and school environments, when they're identified to have a serious gaming or technology addiction, and put them into retreat centers for 30, 60, or 90 days, where they have zero access to any device and are usually focused on being in nature, some kind of health or wellness practice, and just basically living. In some of the studies that have been done around those centers, these teens will basically report, because they're at a developmentally sensitive time of life, having discovered their basic selves for the first time, that they were in their preteens into their tweens and teen years, continually engaged with devices. And so they just didn't know life without it. I'm fairly confident over the coming decade, we're going to see massive amounts of new research, and that could translate into legal actions around regulation. That's going to be a thorny thing that I don't necessarily support, because it tends to be so dysfunctionally delivered. I don't necessarily want to see laws forbidding teenagers from device usage or something clunky like that. But I think that we can start designing, and that's a big focus of my technology group and the communities that I support, is how are we going to stay on this very fast moving technology train and bring about the practices. I actually think a lot of the answers already exist within the communities that are represented by the Embodiment Conference.
Thanks so much, Fazim. I think if you'd like to carry on with, if any further questions pop up or thoughts, I will let you know.
Yes, to anyone listening, feel free at any moment. So, once we start to recognize that embodiment of any kind, good or bad, or disembodiment specifically as driven by reliance on poorly conceived or poorly developed technology devices, once we start to correlate those with entrainment habits and practices, again, very much by design, for those who don't directly study the world of technology engineering, which has two primary facets, the hardware side and the software side, the software side subdivides further into the user interface side. The handle for that is just the letters UX, which borrows from UI, user interface, but also comes out of the notion of user experience. So that's a massive area where it's, to put it succinctly, like marketing merging with the world of engineering, and the intents are always rational, reasonable on the surface, and seemingly good in as much as you want your technology to be accessible to as many people as possible, easy to use, and free of confusion. But while you're designing in that direction, you're often appealing to more base parts of our neuroanatomy. One of the things that drove Tristan Harris, who I referenced earlier, who co-founded the Center for Humane Technology, which is an organization I really recommend looking up if you're intrigued by this. He originally worked at Google. And I believe it was around 2007 that he did some internal whistleblowing because he found a sub-team of developers who went and studied really advanced neuroscientific literature on addiction. So why they were doing that? This is the key part. They wanted to know specifically how the brain gets wired into addictive patterns and how they could learn from that to design interfaces and feedback loops, such as what I've referenced earlier around Infinite Scroll. And remember, if you're a teenager, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when, you know, TV went from 13 channels to like a couple hundred, and having a remote control and being able to surf tons of channels was a big neurological experiential shift, right? Other people who study the psychology of these human factor elements actually call that broad experiential domain, or what Jillian referenced earlier around sensational addictions. It's just called super stimuli, right? One of the views of a lot of what all technological engineering is doing is finding new methods of stimuli design and development so that super stimuli actually becomes part of our lives, right? Incredibly powerful tasting food, potent drinks, potent media feeds that are constantly giving you new input, powerful visuals with high resolution that are so fascinating, you want to stare at them. They all look beautiful, even when you're taking an image of something that's not intrinsically beautiful. That kind of stuff is part of this bigger analysis that we're all engaging right now is, well, is life meant to be that highly virtualized? Is the sensorial and experiential realm, which is kind of a more of a feminine analysis of what all this technology, which tends to have a masculine design, is doing to us. From a Buddhist perspective, that would be talking about the subtle anatomy and the subtle physiology, and how susceptible it is to these patterned and trained hijackings. And sorry, I'm remembering Farsam? That. Yes.
Hello, Farsam. This is Tyler.
Hello, Tyler. Thank you.
This is an amazing conversation. I wanted to ask you a question. So as it seems that technology is a natural manifestation of nature and tends to reflect natural processes, and the better that we design technology to do that, the greater the capacity and the efficiency of the technology becomes. And it seems as though we're going through this polarized period where now more than ever, because of all the things you so gracefully laid out, people are triggered very easy. And it would seem that those that do market, use these technologies for marketing or just for growth hacking, or if it's memological warfare, what are some tools or things that you think people should invite more into their lives to kind of avoid kind of being, becoming, kind of a hamster in this in this little wheel here that seems to be really triggering very intellectual, very capable, as well educated people, as well as those who also are not so educated traditionally.
Thanks, Tyler. Thanks for that very, very prescient question, because it is a very fast moving phenomenon. And there are various layers on which this is taking place. I didn't get into, and not too many people do get into, the psychological aspects of just the continual cultural exposure to thoughts, thought forms, memes, meme processes, just the what gets called an info war or mimetic warfare. We do know that lots of politics right now are very entangled in debates and democratic questions around, you know, are democratic processes around the world being disrupted and themselves hijacked? And I think most of us would tend to agree, yes. And in some places, highly so. We see big tech starting to clean up certain areas and then tripping different wires, which then set off these other cultural conflagrations, such as free speech debates, right? Their appeal usually is we don't want to get into the game of regulating speech. Depending on the cultural landscape that government's embedded within. But practices that I would recommend definitely are drawn from a blend of Eastern wisdom around minimalism and Western practices of just psychological well-being. Not that those two are in different domains, but the overlap tends to be using devices only as needed, trying to challenge yourself to ask and answer on a regular basis one simple question, which is, for me, is this engagement with my device facilitating the flow of my day, or is it distracting me from something within myself that needs to be addressed or engaged? An important side note on the psychological developmental considerations around this, if I can just branch this one in, is for those of us who started heavily relying on technological devices once we were already well into adulthood, there's a very different thing taking place than from those who are still engaging everyday average ontologically given human development, which is they're not getting the time necessary, to have inward introspective self-development become a normal part of the day. And they may consider an hour a profound amount of time, whereas a generation prior might consider a one-week retreat pretty decent, not that impressive, but good and important. But now we're looking at just orders of magnitude differences in the scales that are being considered. And if you don't believe in that difference, you know, do your own inquiries. Ask. My goal is not to critique anyone of a teenage age. My goal is to point out that there are cultural distinct reference points that they might want to, if anyone's watching from that age range, that just a generation ago, a contemplative commitment to a practice would look like at least a 1 week engagement in some set of practices, whether it's retreat-like withdrawal into contemplative work or just personal work. I mean, it could be working with a therapist and journaling and attending a workshop for a 5-day period. That sort of distinction is all I'm making here.
Stunning. Thank you, Farsam.
Farsam, Beverly has, she just wants to reiterate her question a little bit. Yeah. So she says, was about the very intimate placement of optic nerve pathways near oral nerve pathways. Eyes tiring are also, I believe, tied to the positioning of the head, which causes stress on the oral nerves. I guess the question was in consideration of whether or not there was a similar effect on the limbic system, or if one or more directly affected the other.
Beverly, that's a very, very technically sophisticated question, and I think you're already ahead of the researchers. I think that's something that needs to be studied. Now, that's not to say that there isn't some body of work that's already looked at that. I don't know if you can unmute your mic, Beverly. I'd love to ask you, are you referring to the fact that, so like, I'll use myself as an example. My head positioning is going to alter my auditory pathways. I mean, there is this known thing called tech neck, which we all certainly see. Yeah. We tend to have a forward leaning direction for our entire spinal column. and has all kinds of physiological effects, including compressing the diaphragm, which is what feeds into the shallower breathing as a normal part of everyday life. But yes, go ahead, Beverly.
So you've actually just added to it. So, so yes, I'm referring to that because I work with so many people who they're, because of tech neck, because of their heads forward and everything in their day becomes that. And the oral nerves are so intimately, especially around the temporal mandibular, they're so intimately tied. They're so close together that what you're saying when you talked about the limbic system, I'm going, yeah, because I work a lot on people getting their posture so their breath can return, but there's no ever one beginning point. So now you've got me thinking that if the optic nerves are stressing and it's creating an effect on the limbic system, that fight or flight, if the oral nerves as well are having an effect, I guess I'm just wondering if it's more the optic channel that might be the biggest effect now that I should be thinking of, or if it is that pressure around the TMJ that puts so much stress on the oral aspect, the hearing, because if somebody's sense of hearing is disrupted, they're also going to be disconnected from a safe sense of being in the world.
Right, so well said. Are you, may I ask, coming from a craniosacral perspective?
So I'm a yoga teacher, but I draw in all aspects of everything. I'm about the well-being of everyone based on whatever is the best practice for them.
To your point, I've just recently reinvested in an inversion table, and just for a couple of months of twice a day, flipping myself upside down, my spine is decompressed, my neck is decompressed, and I've definitely noticed shifts, just to get very personal and specific. But in general, absolutely. There's another thing. So you're asking, should you be giving more preference to the visual versus the auditory? I would say they all hang together. They're all constantly together. But depending on the individual, absolutely. Either restriction of or limitation of the auditory pathways is going to be something that's going to cause issues, not to mention constant audio feedback, which is overexposure to audio input. I know that there's a lot of neurofeedback platforms now that also place greater emphasis on auditory neurofeedback over visual, because so there's a huge, huge portion of the brain devoted to visual, but also a more root portion of the brain devoted to auditory processing. And so they find greater neurofeedback results from working through the auditory channels rather than just the visual. I know for myself also, I have challenged myself to do digital detoxes where I have no screens to look at. And something, I mean, there's lots of esoteric languaging for this, but something specific seems to kind of come back on fully about 3 days for me out from device exposure, which tells me that when I kind of go back in and sink in those swamps, it's downregulating again. And I think it has to do with our prefrontal cortex, our frontal brain. And that is also a bit of a topic I'd love to explore in the future. And I could easily derail the limited amount of time.
I could sit and talk with you for hours.
Well, we should all go toward the embodiment conference, folks, and talk about whether we can look at how technology and embodiment do merge and marry and bring about global platforms for access to these healings, because there is a bit of a cultural tension, to put it nicely, or an info war, to put it less nicely. But I wanted to add, one of the paradoxes again of this is our prefrontal cortex may be getting less intelligent as we're relying on external devices, exoteric tools to answer questions for us. So we're not doing a lot of our own thinking on the fly. It could be arithmetic, it could be memorization. Yeah. Am I even remembering how to drive somewhere on my own? And again, generational differences. If this is your habit from early in life, you're never given the full chance to exercise or develop that part of yourself. And so I don't want to wait 10 or 20 years to see the fallout from all this. I want to intervene now. And that might be a good pivot point, even if there are some additional questions to answer. I wanted to ask Pam, how many minutes we have left so that I can gauge.
Fazam, we have about 9 minutes left.
Okay.
About 9 or 10 minutes left.
Beverly, I interrupted you if you wanted to conclude.
No, I don't want to take up the time. So I had another question that's probably a little big for right now, whether or not you see a tie into the enteric brain system.
I'd love to answer that. Let me do this. Beverly, and to anyone listening in the future, anyone is welcome to email me at a very easy to remember email address. It's just my first and last name at gmail.com. So farsamshadab@gmail. And if anyone's only got audio on this, the spelling of my name is FarsamShadab, farsamshadab@gmail. And I welcome any and all communications. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
So for the 8 or so minutes, Pam, I'd like to talk about what we're calling transformational futurism. Another polarity that emerges is that there's either a deep over engagement or enmeshment with the reliance on the technocultures, or a serious retreat from it, understandably a polarization and even a disdain of it. Although I'm noticing that those people are harder and harder to find amongst contemporaries. That doesn't mean that there aren't some people that are doing some incredible work keeping technology out of their lives while remaining very functionally engaged in the modern landscape. But with transformational futurism in a nutshell, we're leaning into all these technological tools and looking at new divides that are coming up and hoping to pay forward all this integral and embodied wisdom into that landscape. So part of my participation in the Embodiment Conference and part of my goal with related communities like the Integral community is to continually invite people into participating into this broader project that is now coming together across various continents to change the technological landscape at the local level. And obviously that does start with ourselves, as we've addressed, but it goes into our workplace environments and our domestic and family environments. So there are fairly predictable technological waves that are kind of starting to wash ashore. One of them being that of augmented reality or just immersive media. We know that the 2D screen, be it large or small, only has so many years left. And with a little bit of an advanced view on that landscape, we can definitely start to, through just basic predictive analysis, build and design into that. And one simple answer, rather than throwing a lot of verbiage at this, from my vantage point, is to utilize a lot of different embodiment practices in a manner that answers the deeper questions that are already begged by or asked by all these technological designers and tools. Why are we, other than the obvious reasons, so heavily entrained into the usage of all these tools? We can get into really, really deeply esoteric stuff like the notion of the pineal gland being a central nexus between the left and right hemispheres, whether you want to reference that as the third eye from an Eastern vantage point, or you just want to talk about the neuroanatomy of the pineal gland and its health and well-being. We do know that there's evidence of shrinkage from, again, people who are heavily engaged on devices, maybe 8 hours a day. And that people who are displaying higher stages of cognitive and consciousness development, certainly in an integral model, show highly functioning pineal glands regulating left and right hemisphere in a very relaxed manner, where the brain doesn't seem very neurologically stressed while doing high functioning adult stuff like writing, reading, having a conversation, or driving a car. So with transformational futurism, we're requiring that our technological landscapes over the coming 10 and 20 years, and my research certainly has laid out certain landmarks, but we are requiring that these environments evolve. And in my opinion, this couple year window we're in, from the inception of the 2020s as a decade till about 2022 or 2024, are very critical that new tools, methods, and platforms enter the conversation because of one simple fork in the road that is the given. And sorry if I'm starting to abstract upon my earlier abstractions, but simply put, we've had a 20 or 30 year test run on what technology landscapes are like as far as infrastructure, how they enter, how they get marketed and sold, how they get integrated into our everyday lives, and then how they disrupt our well-being while also making our lives better on the other hand. So there's always this, but it seems as if, and I hope this isn't too much of a surprise for too many people, that the coming fork in the road is going to be about whether the technology becomes even more invasive or is redirected to becoming still very advanced, right? We would define advanced as technology that recognizes the total nature of human beingness, of the ontology of embodiment, and the nature of our actual existential depth. And there's so many ways to phrase that. That wasn't particularly elegant, but what I'm focused on is right now just getting to one simple milestone or landmark, which is the whole body, the whole self. So just a holistic person. So designers today, back to the UX and UI conversation, are basically looking at the human being as a disembodied brain, mind, head that's heartless and organless, so to speak. And that there's certainly no room for Stephen Porges' work in polyvagal tone, right? Thankfully, there are wonderful people and bodies of work that I'm more than happy to reference or refer people to that are finally engaging that subject matter. I will encourage people to Google one new platform that's emerging known as PranaWave, and that's the work of David Lowenfels, and it's spelled like it sounds, PranaWave, P-R-A-N-A. He's taken a really, really sophisticated understanding of Stephen Porges' work and others. I know Stephen has presented here into deeper research on HRV, the notion of heart rate variability that was greatly popularized by the HeartMath folks, and basically forged some new terrain that I will allow David and his wonderful platform to elaborate on. But these are the frontiers. There is a very positive future landscape out there that is not dystopian, that could involve the right use of technology to bridge distances and gaps and bring so-called disintermediated global populations into greater capacity to access medicine and education. One of the goals that is at the forefront of my pursuits, a clear example of that being the use of augmented reality tools on our smartphones in rural and disparate areas that have very little access to medicine, to be able to simply, whether it's through telemedicine, remote care, or even teleeducation in this pandemic era, to simply create accessibility. As the tools grow in sophistication, so will the ability for assessment, analysis, diagnosis, et cetera. And
Faza, I have a quick question here from Johanna, and I think this is kind of going to end it a little bit for us. Any comments on artificial intelligence use for collective mental health?
For collective mental health. So the use of AI for either analyzing that or, so I can answer that different ways. Artificial intelligence could certainly, and is being applied in various domains around understanding the brain and understanding all the neuroanatomy that's necessary to understand a lot of neural processing. It tends to still be highly reductionist, and AI people tend to think that eventually the AI tools will be sophisticated enough to get a whole model. I'm gonna throw out a term that's now coming into usage by a working group that I've been managing. And it's kind of like what happens if Integral starts to develop new jargon. And it's a term that's been around, but very, very rarely utilized, and it's holonomics. So you've got holography and holistic, and then you come into holographics, and we even talk about holomorphics, but holonomics is, well, what happens when we stop flattening nature and using Cartesian systems to reduce everything down to two-dimensional XY axis plottings of the nature of reality. Holonomically speaking, it's not just 3D, it's 4D because there's space and time to consider. And then you end up with a very different approach to artificial intelligence that is actually looking at the whole. So that, to me, all of technology and our pursuits today, I'll hopefully be able to end on this point, is begging the question of, well, what is real? What is reality? How can we engage it and interface it better? And to make sure I put a fine point on a point I started earlier, we want to make sure that we don't go down the road of such deep invasiveness that there's nothing left to map, commodify, analyze, reduce, or one way or another in engage or market. And so what we do is we turn on ourselves and we start to get into to what Elon Musk and others are popularizing around brain computer interfacing, which not only do I claim that they are nowhere near where they think they are, they think they're very close to a mass consumer brain computer interface device, that is completely the wrong path. That is literally, for me speaking personally, completely spiritually giving up on ourselves as human beings, and having to rely on crazy technological assumptions around our deeper ontology and nature and beingness, et cetera. So if there's room to continue, I invite it. If not, I will. Thank you all.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Fazil. Whoa, that was such an informative session. Thank you. And so many notes of appreciation in the chat column. I wish I could read them to you, because the people have really, really enjoyed your session. As you can see in the links, there is more information. You can carry on this chat in the coffee break session, and the link is on the chat. And you can continue the discussion on the conference's Facebook group. The next session on this channel is Stretching Your Mind Gaps by Colin Skelton, just for your information. And then a quick note, you are able to watch this session again for free in the next 48 hours. However, you are able to buy the whole library of the conference with over 1,000 presenters to digest and rewatch a million times in your own time in both audio and video format at a 50% off during the conference. Just also to say, you buying the library enables the very essence of this free conference. So we thank you wholeheartedly in advance. And so, Fazil, just a final word from you. Your top tip on keeping technologically embodied.
Take breaks, challenge yourself to go into longer and longer breaks to remind yourself of what life was like before technology, and explore the possibility of minimizing. Remember, you're always narrowing your field of view too when you're holding a device like this. So roam, let your eyes roam, let your eyes look as far out as you can perceive. And please, I declined that. Are you still here?
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to decline a call, which was hilariously ironic. But I want to thank Mark. I want to thank you, Pam, Robin, and Sarah, and everyone else. Thank you for inviting me, and I look forward to much more. Farsamshadab@gmail.com, again, is the email. Anyone is welcome to write me, and hopefully you will all accept my invitation to become transformational futurists and participate in what we're trying to develop over the coming decade here.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody.